place is the High Command for massacring people, she wrote. They have the power to kill anyone they wish. So oftentimes we can hear the shooting as prisoners are executed not far away. As an American, Agnes had some legal protection and could appeal to the US consul for help if the Chinese arrested her. But as German citizens, Ursula and Sorge enjoyed no extraterritorial legal rights. The fascist consul general, Heinrich von Kollenberg-Bördingheim, was the last person to come to the assistance of two communist spies. If they were caught, they would be at the mercy of the Chinese secret police. Inspector Patrick T. Givens, known as Tom, was the International Settlement's chief spy catcher. For the British administration also saw communism as a dangerous threat. A charming Irishman from Tipperary, with a military moustache and a good line in dirty jokes, Givens had joined the Shanghai Municipal Police back in 1907, rising to become the chief of Special Branch, the police unit responsible for security and intelligence. Givens's job was to track down communists within his jurisdiction and turn them over to the Chinese. On his retirement in 1936, he would receive a Medal of Honor and a commendation from the Shanghai mayor, noting that, in the course of his duties in securing evidence against communists, he frequently worked in close cooperation with the PSB. As one commentator noted, Givens was an executioner at one remove, hounding down communists and suspected Reds and bringing them to justice in the vast majority of cases has meant death. Givens was caricatured as Shanghai's police chief J.M. Dawson in the Tintin comic book The Blue Lotus, where he is depicted by Hergé as a greedy and corrupt arms dealer. Dawson attempts to have Tintin beaten up by prison guards, pointing out that the boy reporter has no papers permitting him to be in the International Settlement. Then he tries to kill Tintin by planting a bomb on his plane. In fact, the jovial Inspector Givens was incorruptible and implacable. He knew there were communist subversives operating on his bailiwick, backed by foreign agitators and bankrolled by the Soviet Union, and he intended to root them out. On the 17th of January 1931, Givens received a tip-off that 36 communists, including five young leaders of the League of Left-Wing Writers, were holding a meeting in the Eastern Hotel. Special Branch swooped, arrested the lot, and handed them over to the PSB. Among those detained was Hu Yipin, the gentle poet married to Ding Ling. News of the arrests spread swiftly through the communist underground. Not until many years later did it emerge that Special Branch had probably been tipped off by Wang Ming, the new leader of the CCP, who regarded the League as a cover for dissenting comrades and wanted them liquidated. As so often in the history of communism, the bloodshed came not from external forces, but through vicious infighting. Ding Ling was frantic, but powerless to lobby for her husband's release. On the 7th of February 1931, 23 of the arrested communists, including three women, were executed at PSB headquarters at Longhua. Hu Yipin was said to have been buried alive. Ursula had little time to mourn or worry whether Hu, under torture, had identified her or other members of the group. 5 days after the executions, her waters broke and she was rushed to the Paolun German Hospital in the International Settlement. She arrived groaning in pain, which prompted the midwife, a Nazi type, to wag her finger and offer an anti-Semitic admonishment. "You should be strong, like a good German woman." On the 12th of February 1931, Ursula gave birth to a boy. He was named Michael, after Michael Gold, the American Marxist she had met in New York 3 years earlier. "I am in heaven over this child, and then again appalled by how I have succumbed to him," she wrote to Jürgen a few days after giving birth. "I think only of the child, and everything else only in relation to the child." When Misha, as she called him, was 11 days old, she wrote home again, and this time only half the letter concerned baby matters, while the rest was about the new Soviet 5-year plan and the writings of the communist leader Karl Radek. At night, she read Infant Feeding and Care, but also, for balance, Boris Pilnyak's novel, The Volga Flows into the Caspian Sea, a paean of praise to forced industrialization in Soviet Russia. The tension between the twin demands of politics and parenthood began the day Ursula became a mother, and continued for the rest of her life. Rudy was instantly besotted with his son. The new parents proudly presented Michael to their friends. Agnes was supportive, but Ursula noticed the sadness in her childless friend. "I sacrificed my children for the struggle," Agnes remarked pointedly. Arthur Jimson, the Commissioner of Public Works, sent over some congratulatory compost. Chen Han Sheng brought traditional Chinese birth gifts and took a great interest in the baby. One of the first visitors was Richard Sorge. Again, Ursula felt the conflicting pull of clandestine work and her maternal instincts. "Partly embarrassed to be involved in such private matters as having babies, and partly proud of my little son." Sorge brought flowers. "I led him to the baby's crib," Ursula wrote. He bent over and gently pulled back the quilt with his hand. For a long time, he looked at the infant in silence. From Sorge's ruthlessly pragmatic perspective, little Misha was a complication, but potentially an asset. He was ideal cover. Who could possibly suspect that a first-time mother with a newborn baby might also be a spy? Chapter 4, When Sonia is Dancing. On the 1st of April 1931, Rudy and Ursula Hamburger moved into their own home on a boulevard lined with plane trees running through the heart of the French concession. Number 1464 Avenue Joffre was a detached two-story villa rented from a British company and set back from the road behind a wide garden. After 9 months in Shanghai, they were keen to put down roots. The Voigt's flat was too small for a growing family. "In the hot season with small rooms directly below the roof, it's not the right place for a child," she told her mother. But Ursula had another reason for moving house. With two or three secret meetings taking place every week, Sorge needed a more secure venue. Marianne Voigt sometimes returned home unexpectedly and had once bumped into him on the doorstep. The comings and goings might already have attracted attention. As a secret rendezvous, the new house on Avenue Joffre was ideal. The servants, cook, houseboy and nanny, or Amma, were housed in separate quarters across a small courtyard. "We have an open view, with no other buildings to block it," Ursula wrote. Anyone coming up the front path would be spotted long before they reached the front door. "Our new home is completely wonderful. Rudy has done a great job with the interior design, and everything is very tasteful. The gardens have beautiful lawns, flowers, and a few tall old trees. It's the first time we have ever lived on our own, and we enjoy it immensely." Rudy knew nothing of the real criteria by which his new home had been selected. The meetings started up again immediately, following the same deliberately unpredictable pattern. Ursula would inconspicuously stand guard in the main room, or, if the weather was warm, in the garden, nursing her baby and keeping a watchful eye on the front gate. While upstairs, Sorge gathered in earnest conclave with men and very occasionally women whose names she never knew. Ursula's letters home gave no hint of her clandestine life. Instead, she vividly described her daily existence, the sights and sounds of Shanghai, and her adored baby. "Michael's hair is still red. His mouth is similar to that of his grandfather. His eyes grow brighter every day. But his nose is still very Christian for the time being. He often greets us with his fist raised as if he is already a red front fighter. But don't worry, since he cannot yet speak, he has not yet expressed his political beliefs." Occasionally, she described the murderous anti-communist violence sweeping China. In some areas, entire families were wiped out. Ursula was fully aware that she could become the next victim. With a baby to care for, the stakes seemed suddenly immeasurably higher. She later wrote, "I had to be constantly on the lookout in case anybody was watching the house, or, for that matter, me. Before and after meetings with the comrades, I kept a discreet watch on the streets." "The white terror is ghastly out here," Agnes Smedley wrote to the American writer Upton Sinclair. In the 4 years of bloodletting that followed the initial Shanghai massacre, at least 300,000 people perished. Suspected communists were rounded up in their hundreds, or simply abducted and murdered by Du's gangsters. "Only a few returned from the prisons," wrote Ursula. "Most never even reached that far. They were shot, beaten to death, buried alive, or beheaded. In provincial cities, their heads were impaled on posts near the city gates to intimidate the people. The foreign powers, of course, strongly support Chiang Kai-shek in his large-scale red suppression campaign. I've seen photographs, which are horrific and genuine. But the communists themselves were also capable of astonishing brutality, particularly towards any of their own suspected of treachery. Gu Shunzhang was a former professional magician, an experienced assassin, and head of the Communist Red Brigade, the so-called Dog Killer Squad, responsible for hunting down party traitors and murdering KMT secret policemen. In April 1931, the PSB arrested Gu, who agreed to cooperate in exchange for his life. A living dictionary of party membership, he revealed the identities of countless communists, most of whom were rounded up and executed. Surviving party leaders went into hiding in the various Shanghai safehouses, but not before they had exacted vengeance. On the orders of Zhu Enlai, the most senior communist left in Shanghai, who would go on to become the first premier of the People's Republic of China, 30 members of Gu's family were kidnapped, murdered, and then buried in a garden in the French Concession, not far from Ursula's new home. Only his 12-year-old son was spared. On a beautiful summer morning, when Michael was almost 6 months old, Ursula received a telephone call from Richard Sorge, not to arrange another meeting, but with an altogether different proposition. "Would you like to go for a ride on my motorbike?" Sorge was waiting for Ursula on the city outskirts, astride an enormous black Zündapp flat twin K500 motorcycle. He showed her how to put her feet into the footrests and told her to hold on. Then they roared off at breathtaking speed. Sorge was a fantastically reckless driver. Soon they were beyond the city limits and flying through the Chinese countryside, past paddy fields and villages, Ursula's arms tightly wrapped around Sorge. Thrilled by his breakneck driving, I urged him to go faster and faster. Sorge accelerated, and the motorbike seemed to take off. Ursula was in a state of petrified ecstasy. "When we stopped," she later wrote, "I was a changed person. I laughed and romped about and talked non-stop. Her anxieties seemed to evaporate. Shanghai's detested social life was forgotten, as were the constant pressures to conform to etiquette, the responsibilities of clandestine activities, and the unnecessary worries about my son. I was no longer afraid." Many years later, she reflected, perhaps he had only arranged this ride to test my physical courage. If, however, he had been seeking a way to establish better contact between us, he had gone about it the right way. After this ride, I no longer felt inhibited. Sorge understood the seductive power of a fast motorbike. Ursula shared his love of risk. He was undoubtedly testing her, though in a way that was more emotional than physical. Exactly when Ursula Hamburger and Richard Sorge became lovers is still a matter of debate. Years later, when quizzed about her relationship with Sorge, Ursula replied obliquely, "I was not a nun." Most sources suggest that their relationship ceased to be platonic soon after this exhilarating motorbike ride, and quite possibly somewhere in the Chinese countryside outside Shanghai that very afternoon. A housewife spy, Ursula had hitherto stood on the periphery of Sorge's network, keeper of a safe house, a discreet enabler who asked no questions. I hardly knew what was going on in my own home. With their newfound intimacy, she joined Sorge's inner circle, a trusted lieutenant in the conspiracy, a partner and confidant. "Our conversations were more meaningful," she wrote. Sorge described his childhood in Baku, his horrific wartime experiences, and his conviction that only communism could defeat the scourge of fascism. He told her of a daughter in Russia he had never seen, by a wife he had never mentioned before. There was no sensational moment when Sorge revealed who he was working for, but over the coming months it became clear to Ursula that her lover was the mastermind of an extensive intelligence operation coordinated and financed by the Soviet Red Army, of which she was now an integral part. Now, when their meetings in Avenue Joffre ended, she did not send Sorge away. Sorge introduced her to the other members of his network. His chief shortwave radio operator, Max Clausen, was a former seaman in the German Navy who had built a tiny 7.5-watt transmitter, small enough to be hidden in a cupboard, but sufficiently powerful to reach the Soviet receiving station in Vladivostok. Clausen's deputy was Joseph Sepp Weingarten, nicknamed Sober because he was usually drunk. Flaxen-haired, rosy-cheeked, good-natured, and remarkably incompetent, Weingarten had married a white Russian exile, but had not got around to telling her he was a communist spy and lived in terror that she might find out. The group's photographer, responsible for copying documents onto miniature film, was a 25-year-old Pole from Łódź named Hirsch Herzberg, who went by the alias Grigor Stronsky, or Grisha. Ursula was struck by his distinctive appearance and grave manner. He had dark, wavy hair with a side parting. His forehead shone as if it were polished. His eyes were dark above his bold cheekbones. As cover, Herzberg ran a camera shop, for which Rudy did the interior design, unaware of its ulterior purpose. Grisha Herzberg became a regular visitor to Avenue Joffre, as Ursula's social and secret lives entwined. Ursula plunged into another chapter of the story, making little notes on this fresh cast of characters. That spring, Herzberg took a photograph of her, drinking coffee from a bowl, peering over the rim. Handing her the developed print, the Polish photographer remarked, "Very well caught, just like you. Could be called Portrait of a Pirate." Ursula's expression, at once mischievous and debonair, is the look of a communist corsair. Then there was Isa. Ursula was instantly drawn to Irene Wiedermeier, sometimes Vita Meyer, a German Jew from Berlin with freckles on her very fair skin, hazy blue eyes and unruly red hair, who ran the Zeitgeist bookshop near Soo Chow Creek. "There is a friend I must tell you about," Ursula wrote home. "A young girl arrived here one day, without kith or kin, but with boxes full of books. She is 23 years old. Plucky, don't you think?" The Zeitgeist was not just a bookshop, and Isa Wiedermeier was more than just a gutsy bookseller. A German Communist Party member from her teenage years, Wiedermeier had married a Chinese communist, studied at the Sun Yat-sen University in Moscow in 1926, left her husband when he became a Trotskyist, lost her baby daughter to meningitis, and wound up in Shanghai. Her bookshop was a branch of the Zeitgeist Buchhandlung Group of Berlin, a chain of shops funded by the Comintern. It was used as a dead-drop site and rendezvous point by the Comintern, Sorge's 4th Department Group, the NKVD, and all the other branches of Soviet intelligence operating in Shanghai. Messages and information were conveyed to agents there on sheets of paper slipped between the pages of designated books. General Charles Willoughby, the American military intelligence chief, later described the Zeitgeist bookshop as a recruiting station for the 4th Bureau of the Red Army. Soviet and other foreign communists literally tripped over one another in Frau Wiedermeier's shop, which measured just 18 feet by 12. The two women became instant soulmates and co-conspirators. "She was like a sister to me," wrote Ursula. Ursula had found a new secret family. "The comrades became my dearest friends," she later wrote. "I felt the same protectiveness towards them as I felt towards my little son. Just as my child's smallest sounds would wake me in the middle of the night, so I was on my guard for the slightest incident or irregularity in the vicinity of my comrades." Sorge began to use her to pass messages between members of his group, a cutout in spy jargon, often via the bookshop. He handed over handwritten notes of information he had secretly gathered on military or economic topics, and she typed them up. Too long to be sent by wireless, these documents, sometimes hundreds of pages long, were sent to Moscow on Soviet ships. As doorkeeper for Sorge's meetings, she developed a nodding acquaintance with some of his agents, including a frail young Chinese girl with short hair, a pale complexion, and slightly protruding teeth, the daughter of a KMT general with access to useful military information. Two of the callers at Avenue Joffre were government officials, polite young men working for the Institute of Social Sciences. She knew them only as Chen and Wang. They offered to teach her Mandarin. Sorge agreed that language lessons would be a good cover for Chen and Wang's frequent visits to the house. A natural linguist, Ursula took delight in deconstructing the complex language. Even the name hamburger, she told her mother, could be broken down into its constituent parts. Han, Bu, Ga. Han equals a famous Chinese surname. Bu equals fine artist. Ga equals good character. Therefore, a first-class artist with good character from the family Han. Doesn't that fit Rudy? And then Ursula. Usu La, pure as an orchid, which doesn't fit me at all. One day, Sorge lugged a suitcase filled with documents into the house and asked Ursula to keep it somewhere safe. She hid it in the built-in cupboard behind a heavy moth-proof chest containing winter clothes. Ursula was now the keeper of records for the Sorge network, as well as printed communist propaganda and other incriminating material. A few weeks later, Sorge returned with a heavy locked trunk and two Chinese porters to carry it upstairs. She stashed it alongside the suitcase. The expatriates, whose company Ursula had once found so tiresome, were now valuable sources of information. At Sorge's instigation, she began to pay more attention to the gossip at the Concordia, around the Katwinkels' swimming pool, and at Bernadine Sol Fritz's tea parties. Constantin von Ungern Sternberg and Karl Seebohm could be surprisingly indiscreet when discussing the business affairs of their employers, Siemens and IG Farben, German companies supplying military technology to the Chinese government. She listened closely to the long political lectures delivered by the journalist Plaut, who never suspected she was ruthlessly squeezing everything out of him. Even the consul general, Heinrich von Kollenberg-Bördingheim, enjoyed chatting with the attractive young wife of the municipal architect. "I did not have to torment myself by adopting the guise of a Nazi," she wrote. Instead, she played the part of a curious, innocuous, and rather bored young housewife who liked to shop without a political thought in her pretty head. Sorge encouraged her to make her own assessments of the information she gathered. Facts were not enough for Richard. If I was too brief, he would say, "And what do you think of that?" When she came back with a fuller report, he would congratulate her. Good, a proper analysis. Almost unaware she was being trained, the tradecraft was seeping into her. The outward appearance and the hidden inner life. Filtering out extraneous material, constant vigilance and habits of deception. Clandestine conduct became second nature, she wrote. On any given evening, gathered around the hamburger's dinner table, might be Jimson from the Municipal Council, Plaut of the Transocean Kuomintang Telegraph Agency, Rosie Graffenberg, owner of the first G-Spot, journalists, military officers, and business people from the club, Agnes Smedley and Professor Chen Hang Sheng from the university. Lubricated by Rudy's wine, the guests chatted freely, most of them unaware that some of the company were spies, notably the hostess. Richard Sorge was a frequent dinner guest. Rudy liked the hard-living German journalist with the fund of risque anecdotes and the big motorbike. As she entertained her dinner party guests, Ursula could feel Sorge's eyes on her across the table, an erotic complicity running invisibly between them. I liked watching Richard listen to me, and I could tell by his expression whether something was important to him or not. According to Sorge's biographer, the table talk reported by Ursula began appearing regularly in his cables to the centre. In his messages to Moscow, Sorge allocated Ursula a code name. Sonia. Sonia is a Russian name, of course, but it also means dormouse, an affectionate term for a sleepy person. Sorge was offering a sly compliment to Ursula's ability to hide in plain sight. A sleeper, in intelligence jargon, is a long-term, deep-cover agent. But in 1930s Shanghai, the Sonyas were also the Russian hookers who lined the North Sichuan Road and whose stock phrase was, "My prince, please, you buy little Sonya small bottle wine?" There was a song popular in Shanghai's nightclubs. When Sonya is dancing to a Russian song, you can't help falling in love with her. There is no more beautiful woman than she. In her blood runs the Volga, vodka, and the Caucasus. Even Vladimir is crazy about her, sets aside a glass of vodka just to see Sonya. The codename carried a significance only Sorge and Ursula understood. Like many spies, Ursula was becoming intoxicated by the thrill of her own duality, the entwining of danger and domesticity, living one life in public and another in deepest secrecy. None of our acquaintances would in their wildest dreams have imagined that I, as the mother of a small child, would jeopardize my family and everything we had created for ourselves in China by contact with communists. Yet the thought of what might happen was invading her own dreams. In one of her nightmares, the police broke down the door, found incriminating evidence, and seized her child. Ursula would wake, shaking, bathed in sweat. She knew she was putting her family into ever deeper jeopardy. That knowledge was not enough to stop her. Spying is highly stressful. So are bringing up a child, running a household in a foreign country, and concealing an extramarital affair. The demands on Ursula required both a genius for compartmentalizing the different areas of her life and intense psychological stamina, as she juggled her rival commitments to husband and lover, bourgeois social engagements and communist subversion, her baby and her ideology. "Underground work cut deeply into my personal life," she wrote. "Rudy was as good and considerate as ever, but I could not talk to him about the people who were closest to me or the work on which my life centered." Under the twin pressures of espionage and infidelity, her marriage was falling apart. Rudolf Hamburger was gentle and trusting, but he was not a fool. He must have noticed that his wife was spending more and more time with her left-wing friends, the red-haired Isa, the somber Grisha. She urged him to invite officials to dinner. Did Ursula's sudden enthusiasm for socializing with people she had previously detested strike him as odd? Did he wonder why Johnson, the good-looking German journalist with the English name, was a fixture at almost every dinner party they hosted? Did he suspect that his wife might be otherwise engaged on her afternoons while he worked at the office in downtown Shanghai? Most cuckolds are, often unknowingly, complicit. Did he refuse to see what he did not want to see? Agnes Smedley certainly did know what was going on between Ursula and Sorge, and she was not happy. Agnes was an advocate of free love, so long as the freedom was hers. The romantic aspect of her relationship with Sorge had already ended, as she had predicted it would. But the discovery that her young protégé was now her ex-lover's lover did not fit in with her plans. When word of the affair reached Agnes, she took it badly. In private, she was still affectionate towards Ursula, but when others were present, Sorgay in particular, she made snide remarks and took every opportunity to put her down. She mocked Ursula's interest in clothes, cookery and entertaining. Clausen, the radio operator, decided Agnes was a hysterical, conceited woman. Sorgay's switch of partners added a new and unpredictable element to an already combustible sexual and political mix. One afternoon, Sorgay arrived at the house accompanied by a large man with a round, almost bald head, small eyes and a sudden, friendly smile. They were joined by two Chinese men Ursula had never seen before. Half an hour later, she entered the upstairs room with a tea tray and found the four men holding revolvers. There were also weapons lying in the open trunk and spread out on the carpet. Rifles, handguns, machine guns and ammunition. The two Chinese comrades were learning how to take the weapons apart and reassemble them. Sorgay ushered her out of the room, but he had doubtless intended her to see the cache of weaponry. Here was further proof of her importance. There was enough evidence in her bedroom cupboard to get them all killed. She was now not only Sorgay's lover, confidant, courier, secretary, secret agent and archivist, but also custodian of the group's arsenal. "I was of greater use than I had realised," she wrote, "and in even greater danger." Towards the end of June, Sorgay appeared at the house without warning, sweaty and anxious. Two porters were waiting at the gate. "You need to pack a suitcase for you and Michael," he told her. "You may have to leave Shanghai suddenly and go into hiding with comrades in the interior." Sorgay gave her the address of a safe house where she and the baby could hide and await exfiltration to the Yangtze Soviet. There was no suggestion Rudy would be going too. Sorgay promised to telephone with a prearranged signal if the moment came to flee. The porters hauled the trunk and suitcase containing weapons and documents downstairs, and Sorgay hurried away. With trembling hands, Ursula immediately packed a small case with nappies, baby clothes, sterilized water, powdered milk, and a change of clothing. Waiting for the telephone to ring, she tried to reassure herself that, since Richard knew of a specific danger and an opportunity to escape had been provided, the situation was no more precarious than before. At night, she lay awake alongside Rudy, rigid with tension and awash with adrenaline, waiting for the signal to bolt. While the nurse played with Michael in the garden, she stayed in the house, never more than a few feet from the telephone. Soldiers often describe experiencing a jolt of pure excitement when they come under fire. Ursula was very frightened. She was also elated. Facing death, she had never felt more intensely alive. Ursula knew the cause of the crisis without having to ask. The network had been compromised. A few days earlier, on the 15th of June 1931, the Shanghai Municipal Police had arrested Professor Hilaire Noulan and his wife Gertrude at their home on Sichuan Road. Noulan went by a baffling array of names, nationalities and occupations, all of them false. He variously identified himself as Paul Christian, Xavier Alois Buret, Paul Rueg, Donat Boulanger, Charles Allison, Philippe Louis de Backer, Samuel Hersens, Ferdinand van der Kruisen, Richard Robinson Rubens, and Dr. W. O'Neill. He claimed, at different times, to be Belgian, Swiss, and Canadian, a professor of French and German, a wallpaperer, a labourer, a mechanic, and a pacifist trades union organiser. Not to be outdone, Madame Noulan sometimes used the names Sophie-Louise Herbert, née Laurent, or Marie Mott. Noulan was a small, sharp-eyed and extremely nervous man in his late 30s. Forever moving about and switching from one to another of his three languages, apparently without noticing. While Inspector Tom Givens might be unsure exactly who this twitchy little man was, he quickly established what he was: an important Soviet spy. The trail had started with the arrest in Singapore of a suspicious Frenchman, Joseph Ducroux, a known Comintern courier travelling under the alias Serge Lefranc. On a scrap of paper, Ducroux had scribbled a telegraphic address, Île aux Noules, Shanghai, belonging to the mysterious Noulonses. Givens kept the couple under surveillance for a week and then launched a lightning raid in the middle of the night. A key in Noulonses' jacket pocket opened an apartment on Nanking Road, where police found three steel boxes containing hundreds of documents, many in double encrypted code. A copy of The Three Principles by Sun Yat-sen on the bookshelf was found to contain the key to the code. When decrypted, the cache turned out to be an encyclopedia of Soviet espionage in Shanghai, including contacts with the CCP. Payroll records revealed the names of couriers and agents throughout the region, and communist spies in every corner of the city, including, to Givens's astonishment, inside the police force itself. The man Givens had arrested was clearly the main fulcrum for subversive communist plotting, with six passports, stolen, borrowed, or expertly forged, a staff of nine people, no fewer than 15 safe houses around the Far East, 10 bank books, 8 post office boxes, 4 telegraphic addresses, 2 offices, 1 shop, and an enormous budget for subversion. In the preceding 10 months, he had dispensed a staggering £82,200 to communists in China, the Malay States, Japan, Burma, Indochina, Formosa, and the Philippines. Soviet cash was also funding Mao's Red Army in its war with the nationalist government. The Noulonses, it seemed, were involved in every phase of communist activity in the Far East, with Moscow as the controlling centre. Noulon was really Yakov Matveyevich Rudnik, a Ukrainian Jew with an impeccable revolutionary pedigree who had taken part in the storming of the Winter Palace in 1917 before going on to work as a Comintern agent in the Crimea, Austria, France, and finally China. His wife, Tatiana Nikolaevna Moyasenko-Velikaya, was the daughter of an aristocrat and a gifted mathematician who left her post in the economics faculty of the University of Petrograd to become a spy. They had arrived in Shanghai in March 1930. Givens never discovered the real identity of the man in his custody, but he was triumphant. These archives offered a unique opportunity of seeing from the inside and on unimpeachable documentary evidence the workings of a highly developed communist organization of the illegal order. Rudnik's arrest was a hammer blow to Soviet espionage in the Far East. Stalin himself immediately gave orders to the Comintern to close all its extensive Shanghai operations and evacuate its staff immediately. Soviet spies began fleeing in anticipation of mass arrests. Agnes Smedley headed to Hong Kong, leaving in such haste that she carried no luggage. Gerhard Eisler, the German enforcer who had insisted Ursula wear a hat, made for Berlin. Some did not escape fast enough or had nowhere to go, and dozens of communists were arrested. The party organization in Shanghai, already fragile, was left in tatters. In Hong Kong, the British police picked up a young Indochinese cook named Ngaian I Kwok, the son of a Confucian scholar whose embrace of communism had taken him to France, America, China, and Britain, where he worked as a pastry chef on the New Haven Dieppe ferry. As head of the Indochinese Communist Party, he had been in regular communication with Noulon and was sentenced to 2 years in prison by the Hong Kong Military Tribunal. After his release in 1933, Kwok went on to become the architect of Vietnam's independence movement, Prime Minister and leader of the Viet Cong during the Vietnam War. He is better known as Ho Chi Minh. Armed with the Noulon documents, the Chinese authorities tracked down hundreds more communists in what was chillingly described by the British as the resolute, timely, and decisive application of repressive measures. The urban communist movement in China was shattered, its leadership dispersed, the survivors living in fear. The secret police combed the city, raiding one safe house after another. Zhu Enlai fled to the mountains of Yangtze, disguised as a priest. By the beginning of 1932, there were just two CCP Central Committee members left in Shanghai. A foreign journalist, writing before the Holocaust, described the White Terror as having no parallel in history, except perhaps the invasions and slaughters staged by the Huns in the 4th and 5th centuries. Sorge remained undiscovered. None of his agents were on the Nulands' payroll, and as yet the police had not made the connection. Sorge was now the sole senior Soviet intelligence officer in the city, with the unenviable task of sorting out the mess and doing everything possible to free the Rudniks. Ursula, Isa Wiedermeyer, Grisha Hertzberg and the rest of Sorge's team were told to stand ready to flee at a moment's notice. But as the days passed without the emergency escape signal, Ursula began to relax. The suitcase of documents and the trunk of weapons were returned to their hiding place in Ursula's cupboard. The meetings resumed. "From now on," she wrote, "I kept a suitcase ready packed for Misha and myself." By repeatedly changing their identities, the imprisoned Rudniks were keeping the authorities at bay. It is very hard to prosecute someone if you do not know who they really are. Meanwhile, the Nulands affair had become an international cause célèbre, with left-leaning celebrities, fellow travellers, intellectuals, scientists and writers lining up to insist that the accused couple were simply peace-loving union organisers cruelly hounded by the fascistic Chinese government. At this moment, Sorge asked Ursula to perform a task more dangerous than anything she had attempted before. "Will you hide a Chinese comrade whose life is in danger?" This was an instruction framed as a request. It was also a calculated gamble. Concealing a communist fugitive in the house on Avenue Joffre would be impossible without Rudy's knowledge. Indeed, it required his active collaboration. Ursula knew that Sorge was testing both her resolve and the state of her marriage, but there was no choice. "I had to take Rudy into my confidence." She was under no illusions. Rudy was unlikely to react well to the discovery that his wife was a communist spy. Chapter 5: The Spies Who Loved Her. During their time in Shanghai, Ursula had detected a small but distinct shift in Rudy's politics. Like her, he was appalled by the White Terror, the grinding poverty, the complacency of the expatriate bourgeoisie growing fat on Chinese misery. Moreover, events in Germany were propelling him further to the left. In 2 years, the Nazi Party had been transformed from a rump group of extremists into the most powerful political force in Germany, combining terror tactics with conventional political campaigning amid a blizzard of racist, anti-communist, nationalist propaganda. The paramilitary brown shirts beat up opponents, staged mass rallies, and smashed the windows of Jewish shops, while Hitler toured the country whipping up anti-Semitic fury. In the elections of July 1932, the Nazis would win nearly 14 million votes to become the largest single party in the Reichstag. Facing electoral oblivion, the KPD increasingly turned to violence. For Ursula, the disturbing news from Germany was further proof that only communism could resist the rise of fascism. And to her satisfaction, Rudy was coming around to the same view. "He moved closer to me politically," she wrote. But there were limits. When Ursula told Rudy she wanted to shelter a fugitive Chinese communist under their roof, he exploded. "You are overestimating yourself," he insisted, "and you're not as tough as you think. The risk for you and for Misha is just too great." She responded with equal force. "Your attitude could cause the death of a comrade, and for that I would never be able to forgive you." The argument raged back and forth until Rudy relented, or rather bowed, to an eventuality over which he had little control and agreed to shelter the communist. He was now, against his will and better judgment, complicit in the conspiracy, a part of the Sorge network. This might have brought Ursula and Rudy closer, but something vital had broken. Their secret house guest arrived the next afternoon, a small, polite, evidently grateful, and extremely scared young Chinese man who spoke no English at all. Hamburger tried to make the best of the strange situation. Once he was actually living with us, Rudy was anxious to make our guest feel at home and was warm and friendly towards him, insofar as this was possible without a common language. The young communist hid in the upper floors of the house, emerging only at night to walk in the garden. When there were dinner guests, he lay motionless in bed, fearful his movements would be heard in the rooms below. Even the servants were unaware of his presence. After 2 weeks, he was gone, spirited into the interior and the safety of the Yangtze Soviet area. The immediate threat was lifted, but a crackling tension lingered. "It was clear to me," Ursula wrote, "that our marriage could not continue like this much longer." The secret meetings resumed, but less frequently. Sergei was affectionate and solicitous towards Ursula, but preoccupied with the Nulong's case and going through one of his periodic bouts of extreme recklessness. He drove his motorcycle at speed into a wall and smashed his left leg. "What difference does another scar make?" he joked when Ursula dropped in on him in hospital. The Nulongses, awaiting trial in Nanking Prison, had a 5-year-old son known as Jimmy. His real name was Dmitri. Even the children of spies have cover names. Agnes Smedley had returned to Shanghai to coordinate the Nulong's defense committee. She became Jimmy's temporary guardian, a role she fulfilled by showering him with presents like a little prince. When Ursula suggested this was not a good idea, Agnes angrily retorted that Ursula should take the child into her own home. Ursula was tempted. "I would try to give him the maternal affection he needed, and Misha would have a big brother." But Sergei quashed the idea, since it would establish a direct link between Ursula and the imprisoned Soviet spies. "It meant giving up my illegal work, and neither he nor I wanted that," she wrote. But Agnes did. Having got Ursula into the spy game, she now wanted her out. Determined to extend the Soviet sphere of influence in the Far East, Moscow increased its covert support for Chinese communism. A fresh cadre of Soviet agents arrived in Shanghai to rebuild the communist networks after the Nulong debacle and maintain the combative spirit of party members and their sympathizers. Arthur Ewert, a veteran German revolutionary, appeared in 1932 and took over as the Comintern's chief liaison with the CCP, along with his wife, the Polish-born Elise Saborowski, known as Szabo. The Ewerts would eventually meet a grisly fate. Szabo perished in a German concentration camp while Arthur Ewert was captured in Brazil and tortured into insanity. The fat, bald, smiling man that Ursula had seen handling guns in her spare room a few months earlier revealed himself to be Colonel Karl Rimm, codenamed Paul, a Red Army veteran from Estonia and Sorge's deputy. Rimm ran a restaurant in the French concession with his wife Louise, a buxom, motherly Latvian woman who coded and decoded wireless messages to and from Moscow. There was one more notable figure on the fringes of this group, a 27-year-old Englishman named Roger Hollis, significant less for what he was in 1932 than what he would become many years later. The son of an Anglican bishop, Hollis had flirted with communism at Oxford before he dropped out, set off for China as a freelance journalist, and then joined British American Tobacco, the multinational company whose Shanghai factory manufactured 55 billion cigarettes a year. Hollis was sociable and socialist. He certainly knew some of the Sergei group, including Karl Rimm, and may have met Sergei himself. According to Sergei's biographer, Hollis was one of the guests at the Hamburger House. Hollis's flatmate, Anthony Staples, later gave evidence that an American woman and a German man, believed to be Agnes Smedley and the new Comintern chief, Arthur Ewert, had visited Hollis at his home. There is even some evidence that the Englishman had a 3-year affair with Louise Rimm, Karl's wife. Ursula later claimed to have no memory of Roger Hollis. The presence, or otherwise, of this shadowy Englishman in the Sorgay circle would be irrelevant, had Hollis not made a significant career change on his return to Britain from the Far East. In 1938, he joined MI5, the British Security Service, and would go on to become its Director General with direct responsibility for hunting down Soviet spies in Britain at the height of the Cold War. Many years later, the suspected links between Hollis, Ursula, and her communist friends would provoke a damaging internal mole hunt inside MI5, based on the unproven but persistent conspiracy theory that Hollis was a communist spy recruited in Shanghai back in 1932. Sorgay's network forged close internal bonds, as secret societies always do. The group went on excursions to the Chinese countryside, sightseeing trips that were also espionage works outings. Rudy seldom accompanied his wife on these jaunts. Generous and good-hearted as always, he was pleased for me whenever I had a chance to get out of Shanghai, even if he could not come himself. Rudy insisted he had too much work. The modern home furniture business now had 20 Chinese employees and a backlog of orders, but in reality he was also holding back, unwilling to get entangled in Ursula's spy community. There is a poignant photograph from this time of Rudy and Ursula asleep in the sun during a picnic. He has his arm around her as if trying to cling on. She sleeps at an angle to him. They continued to make plans together. In May 1932, she wrote to her parents, "Rudy and I think more and more that once his contract finishes, we will make a new start in Russia. I'm pretty confident that we will both find work in Russia. There are 100 reasons for Russia and against Shanghai. Unfortunately, not all of them writable." In another letter she wrote, "I'm going to study Russian here intensively for the next 6 months. I want Rudy to learn Russian too. You never know." She did not explain that many of her new communist friends spoke Russian, nor that her instructions from the centre were written in Russian, nor that Sorgay had advised her to learn the language if she wished to continue working for Soviet military intelligence in the future. Ursula's photograph albums contain numerous images of the young communist and her spy friends at play. Ursula linking arms back to back with Karl Rim to play seesaw. Agnes Smedley in earnest conversation with Chen Hangsheng, the university lecturer and secret communist agent. On one occasion, Ursula and Agnes joined the rest of the gang for a 3-day boat trip up the Yangtze. Szabo cooked for all of us in the houseboat kitchen, and Agnes told jokes. Sorgay was carefully fostering team spirit. It may have been unusual for comrades who worked illegally to meet for such a sightseeing excursion, but it was not irresponsible, wrote Ursula. To outside observers, they looked like any other group of expatriate friends, an assortment of foreigners thrown together by chance in a strange land. Ursula would look back on those days as something quite rare and precious. She was still only 25 years old. "I ran races around the meadow with Richard Sorgay and Karl Rim until we all collapsed into the grass from too much running and laughing." Her zest for life was infectious. She would always cherish the memory of a simple game of tag in a field with her friends and her secret lover. One evening early in 1932, Ursula joined Sorgay, Rim and Grisha at a hotel room in downtown Shanghai to welcome another new arrival. Our dark-eyed, dark-haired host was a vivacious man whom I had not seen before. He was introduced as Fred. The party was bibulous and convivial. Fred told funny stories and sang German and Russian songs in a fine baritone. He had a beautiful voice, Ursula recalled. 2 days later, Sorgay asked Ursula to deliver a cardboard tube to him containing rolled-up documents. Fred invited her to stay for a drink. For reasons she could never quite explain, Ursula felt drawn to confide in this man she barely knew, describing her political alienation from Rudy and the strain her clandestine work was putting on their marriage. "Should we separate?" she asked. Fred listened patiently and told me he felt honoured by my confidence. Sensibly, he offered no opinion on her marriage. After 3 hours of intense conversation, Ursula headed into the night, oddly elated. Later it occurred to her that the sympathetic Fred had been interviewing her, probing my suitability for the work. Later still, she discovered who he was. Fred's real name was Manfred Stern, one of the heroes of 20th century communism and, almost inevitably, one of its victims. An early revolutionary, he had led a partisan unit of the Red Army against the mad Baron Roman von Ungern Sternberg, whose brother Konstantin was a fixture of Shanghai's German club. Stern joined the 4th Department of the Red Army and was deployed to New York in 1929, where, from a safe house on 57th Street, he ran a network of spies extracting America's military secrets, copying stolen documents in a photographic shop bought for the purpose in Greenwich Village, and shipping them back to Moscow. The sympathetic, sweet-voiced Fred was a rising star of Soviet military espionage. He was in China as chief military advisor to the CCP and a recruitment agent for the center. Moscow was beginning to take an interest in Agent Sonia. Michael was now a toddler and beginning to speak. "Misha is walking around in a white blouse with green flowered linen underpants," she told her mother. "For 3 weeks now he has been walking independently through the garden and all the rooms, smelling all the flowers, falling over, getting up again, growling, trying to take the steps to the garden, tumbling down, screaming murderously, suddenly discovering a little bird on a tree and falling silent in the middle of a wail. Says, 'Daddy, Daddy, Mummy,' and especially 'Money, Money, Money,' which, to my horror, the Amma has taught him. I made up for it by teaching him 'dirty.' And now he repeatedly chants 'dirty money.'" On the 28th of January 1932, Japanese Imperial forces attacked Shanghai. The previous autumn, Japan had invaded Manchuria, occupying 1.3 million square kilometers of China and establishing a puppet government in the region the Japanese renamed Manchukuo. Next, the expansionist Japanese military turned its attention to Shanghai, where Japan had existing extraterritorial rights. Claiming to be defending its citizens against Chinese aggression, Japan assembled 30 ships, 40 aeroplanes, and 7,000 troops around the Shanghai shoreline and then attacked the Chinese areas of the city. The Chinese 19th Route Army put up a fierce resistance. The conflict barely touched the international concessions, but it seriously alarmed Moscow, since Japanese incursions into China represented a potential threat to the Soviet Union. Sorge was instructed to find out what was going on. He dispatched Ursula Hamburger and Isa Wiedermeier to the war zone. "This not undangerous mission," Ursula wrote later with ringing understatement, "was best undertaken by women." The two foreign females were stared at but left alone as they wandered through the burned-out and looted Chinese neighbourhoods. "Japanese soldiers are prowling everywhere," Ursula reported. "Whole streets are empty except for a few corpses, and the only sound to be heard in the deathly hush is the rumbling of heavy armoured Japanese military vehicles. The poor were left in their gutted houses, millions of unemployed, and they're dead." Ursula and Isa visited wounded Chinese soldiers in hospital, gauged the morale of the troops, and assessed the impact of the Japanese attack. Sorge was amazed by the quality of the information gathered by his women spies, now operating more like war correspondents reporting from the front line. "I was also able to give Richard an accurate picture of the mood among Europeans," she later wrote. The fighting ended after a few weeks with a ceasefire brokered by the League of Nations, but not before Ursula had witnessed a sight that shook her soul. "I found a dead baby in the street," she wrote. Ursula picked up the tiny corpse. Its nappies were still wet. The child was around the same age as Michael. Here, with appalling clarity, was a measure of what was at stake. She might frame the Japanese action in political terms, a clear and brutal lesson in the methods of capitalism, but it was also a warning of the pitiless world she now inhabited. If Ursula was caught and executed, the next dead child lying in the street might be her own. Rudy was appalled by the Japanese attack and furious. "It is an outrageous and shocking thing to invade a weak country," he wrote to his parents. "What we are witnessing here is military aggression conducted